Good morning, Spokane. You're listening to Praxis. My name is Taylor Weech, and I'm here live in the studio today with David Brookbank, a longtime local activist in Spokane on a variety of issues and former State Department employee, and we're going to talk about all kinds of things today. How are you doing?
Good. I'm not always used to being introduced as a former State Department employee, although I was for 4 years, and sometimes I can't figure out how my head got spinning around to have ended up doing that. But it was part of, you know, becoming who I am, I guess.
Great. So are you from Spokane?
I am. I was born here Cinco de Mayo, 1958. My dad was a U.S. Air Force B-52 pilot stationed at Fairchild. And I was the first of five kids born here and at Moses Lake, where there used to be Larson Air Force Base.
Nice. So you spent a good deal of your, I'm trying to calculate age-wise, your 20s and 30s involved in activism in Spokane.
Yeah, and I would say the latter, you know, the last 15 years as well. I mean, I've by profession, I guess, I'm a social worker. I actually am currently a financial worker in the welfare office, but I've, like my mother and like my little sister, I've done a lot of child protective service social work in Washington State. And but in the context of that and around that, I've come and gone from that many times since the early 80s, mostly to Latin America and working with organizations like Witness for Peace in Nicaragua, with the Rio Grande Defense Committee in on the U.S.-Mexico border, and then just through my own involvement with the Latin American community, whether it was the radio program I had here for 3 years, Los Caminos de la Vida, or just trying to facilitate, you know, the access to services and ability to cope with our society of Latinos who are friends of mine.
So that's been a focus for a long time. And I know when we talked before this interview, you mentioned being involved with CASA, which is Central American Solidarity Association.
Correct.
In Spokane. Mm-hmm. And also with CISPES, which is Community in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador.
The Committee in Solidarity Committee with the People of El Salvador. That's right.
Pretty close on the acronyms. Yeah. Can you explain just a little bit about both of those groups and what the work was and kind of what the concept of solidarity means to you and to that group?
Well, you know, coming over here today, I heard the David Cobb interview that was just going on, the David Barsamian program. And, you know, he discussed the word solidarity at one point. And I think that is the most powerful word that exists in my mind. It is the key to anything that we're going to do politically to succeed. It has to do with our ability to recognize our sameness with the people around us and our common kind of cause, whether that's survival on the planet and the survival of the planet or our political futures. And I think so it's our solidarity that the divide and conquer strategy of the elite is and the wealthy and the powerful is directed at. It's our ability to say, you know, you are my brother or sister that is threatening to them, because once we all join hands, you know, it's sort of game over. Once we all recognize, okay, that's what we need to be fixing in the world, and we unite to do it. And so, you know, for me, anything that is related to that solidarity is key. So, you know, in the United States was involved in creating and financing and supporting dictatorships, right, over Latin America, as we have all over the world. And Central America were some of the most, the grossest dictatorships that we've supported. The Somoza family's dynasty in Nicaragua, the reign of generals in Guatemala from the 50s through the mid-1980s, and other, you know, at the El Salvador, the barbarian government of El Salvador. And so the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador was one attempt to link people's activism in the United States to the causes of freedom and liberation in Central America, of the people of El Salvador in particular, where the United States had decided to kind of really heavily invest in the survival of a death squad regime, as it was called at the time, that massacred large numbers of people and had been for decades. The Itzalco massacre in 1932 in El Salvador, that is considered to have killed about 30,000 people and sort of resulted in, if you go to El Salvador and compare it to Guatemala, you notice that in El Salvador, people aren't wearing traditional native garb. And part of that is because of the extent of the repression and that particular massacre. People just masked their indigenousness. But the Committee in Solidarity of People of El Salvador was a very powerful movement here in the United States that's been studied and written about in terms of its effectiveness and the extent to which it mobilized on campuses and in communities. And here in Spokane, it just happened that in the early 1980s, a group of activists came together. A lot of them had been working on nuclear freeze issues when we kind of, you know, our passion for Central America continued, and we recognized that others of us had come from places like Boulder and University of Washington, Seattle, where we had formed CISPUS chapters. I'd helped form a chapter at the University of Washington. Lisa Brown had been involved with CISPUS in Boulder. Others had come from other CISPUS-connected backgrounds, Eric Ream, a number of other people. So it was a very effective organization. We met in sitting in a circle. If there were 15 people, 15 chairs, if it expanded, if it was a at times we had as many as 45 or 50 people meeting at Gonzaga in the administration building. We rotated the chairmanship of the meetings, and we had a notebook that the roles were shared among people. It was a very effective way to run an organization, I think. We had a number of successful guerrilla theater type actions in the streets, simulating, you know, death squad actions, we also did sit-ins in Tom Foley's office on the eve of major votes on Contra Aid. There were large arrests in front of the federal building and several other civil disobedience arrests. A lot of programs. We brought speakers through from Central America. So to me, it's a model of what can happen. And I believe that one of the things that's missing right now is real true solidarity around an international issue. So Palestine would be one, for example, where people are trying to do that here.
Okay. And how do you think... Do you think that those actions that you participated in the 80s helped the community at large understand the issue better? Because I think that sometimes that's the issue especially with international policy. It's really abstract to people. And I would argue that it's become more so, even though the world's more globalized now and we have so much access to information. I think even more so, people are utterly disconnected from the repercussions of the actions of the country they live in around the world. What do you think is a good way? Were those effective to get people to understand, and what might be some other ways to just elevate people's consciousness in their role?
I agree with you. I think people are disconnected. You know, you were looking up some articles. This is a picture from the Spokesman Review. This is David Biviano. I don't know if you know who David is, but he's the father of Amy, who's a local Democratic Party person. This is David being dragged by federal building security into the building. He was one of, I believe there were 18 of us arrested that day in front of the federal building. And the extent of that war and the controversy of it, the brutality of it, was such that the Spokesman Review provided pretty considerable coverage of this, partly maybe because Tom Foley was Speaker of the House and was key in his involvement. But, you know, at that time, there were some pretty, you know, there were professors, there were church people, there were Jesuit priests and others involved in this. You know, I guess you could call them mainstream folks. And the issue was very close to home, Central America being close to home. People got out in the streets. Kids were asking their parents, you know, what's going on over there? So there was created a certain amount of excitement. And the group was using techniques that drew attention, like the guerrilla theater type. We created a mock death squad and took awarded Tom Foley's office and Senator Slade Gordon's offices the white hand of death, the mark of the Salvadoran death squads. They would leave a white print, painted handprint on the door of somebody that they were going to kill. So, you know, it got a lot of attention. I think how you reach people, one of the things that's unfortunately going on is everything, most people are tied into electronic communications. We can break through with alternative websites and things like that. But most people, it seems, are still listening to mainstream media. NPR is a great example of something that's just really I see as basically a voice, a mouthpiece for the elite kind of media. And so everything's interpreted that way. When you get people together around something on the streets, bystanders or even those who have just joined the movement and have questions, you get to hear real people talking about, well, why are you so impassioned by Central America? Well, you know, I was there in the Peace Corps, and I saw these things that just didn't make sense with what the U.S. government line was, what I had been told in my training for the Peace Corps. I met with these people, and I saw, you know, the conditions they were living in, or other stories. People, it's in the real contact with one another that we transmit passion. I mean, I think it can be done with what you're doing here on this radio station. I think this, when I heard that you had, first of all, I'd heard of you, so I already knew, knew what activist circles you ran in. And I also, I knew of the station, of course, but then when I heard the title of the program, Praxis, I thought, wow, somebody's trying to continue to pierce the silence. And so together with solidarity is this idea of piercing the silence. And that's the other thing that I've tried to do over the years, whether it's, you know, my activism on the streets with other activists, or the radio program that I had, or speaking to people at work, my blog, Spokane Police Abuses. You know, I personally am one who thinks that it's really important for us to be on the left. I consider myself to be on the left, to be participating in all forums. So, you know, after articles on the Spokesman Review, there's a place to leave comments. And I feel it's really important to participate in those forums, just because Miami Herald, I mean, talk about a voice that of kind of support of U.S. policy against Cuba and in support of the blockade, and, you know, kind of what passes for quote unquote anti-communist kind of bastion. I go into that fray with those people and get threat that, you know, I've been told there's a bullet with my name on it, you know. And so I feel that this idea of the word became flesh, I don't hear that in a religious sense, except to the extent that I believe Jesus, if there was a Jesus, was a liberation theologist and a revolutionary. In that sense, you know, what we think in our heads, these analysis that you have and many other people I've met have, unless you speak it, it doesn't exist. It's not been transformed into any real reality.
Mm-hmm. And then ideally, from speaking it, if enough people are speaking it, then you can do it.
You identify somebody who holds a common view. You make, you know, solidarity with that person. And I believe that our solidarity with the Latin Americans is crucially important, because right now they're the people that I see who have really defied the empire, you know, in the empire's backyard, as it's been defined for so many years. We've seen these liberation movements where people sacrificed many lives to liberate their countries, and have also created political movements and adapted political systems to meet the needs of the people. Not only do they need our support, because our government continues to try to subvert them through the CIA, through the reactivation of the U.S., you know, the Fourth Fleet and other U.S. military endeavors in the area, but we're also going to need the people of Latin America as our situation becomes more repressive. They're the people that are going to show us the way, and we're going to need their solidarity in reverse. And so that's part of the importance of solidarity, is that it's a two-way street. You know, I need you as much as you need me.
Awesome. So can you talk about, I know, so we talked a little bit about El Salvador, Guatemala. You also spent time with Witness for Peace in Nicaragua.
Right.
Is that true? And can you explain a little bit about what that organization is and what the political situation in Nicaragua was when you were there?
Well, I would say Nicaragua is where my soul resides. I was in Nicaragua in November with my mom during the elections down there, and I would tell people, they would ask me what I was doing, because I wasn't there as a tourist. I was there kind of making a reconnection with the people in the country from those years of the 80s when I was there, and I told people I was looking for the place that to bury myself when I die. And I really do mean that. There's something about especially the mountains, the Segovias of northern Nicaragua, and the people of that area that you know, I was deeply affected by during my time there. And so were a number of people here. Turns out that I went to Nicaragua. I left a job as a social worker with the state of Washington a week before I would have been a permanent employee, went to Nicaragua for the first time to study Spanish. And I lived in a house with a family, and I think this was one of the most important things, both in my acquisition of Spanish, but also in my connection with that country and those people, was studying Spanish, living with families. And I lived in a house that, it turns out, another fellow from Spokane, Tom Carrier, who's now on the Northwest Regional Power Planning Commission, has been for a number of years, professor of economics out at Eastern at one point. He lived in the same house with the same family. And the school in Esteli that I, in northern Nicaragua, that I studied at, M.K. Hughes, was on the staff of, the daughter of former Mayor Sherry Bernard was an activist in Nicaragua, working for an organization in Managua. So many other people in Spokane were in Nicaragua in the 1980s. It's like, in a way, the Occupy maybe experience and traveling around the country is going to be maybe to your generation, or, you know, I'm not exactly sure what your generation will define for itself as like key to its identification as activists and, you know, but Nicaragua at the time, you know, July 19th, 1979 was the triumph of the Sandinista Revolution. People in Nicaragua had begun organizing in the 50s, and definitely by the 60s, they had gone to the mountains in Nicaragua to organize a guerrilla movement against the Somoza dynasty that had been put in power and maintained by the United States, Somoza and his two sons, from the 1930s. And they had organized and fought, and by, you know, the mid to late 70s, the brutality of the Nicaraguan regime was such, the Somoza National Guard was such, that people all over the country were just waiting for someone to liberate them. People began to take up arms alongside the Sandinistas, and they were Somoza, after bombing Esteli three times, aerial bombing, fled the country to Miami, where all good U.S.-backed dictators go, and then the people marched into Managua on July 19th. That's by the very early in the start of that government. The French offered military assistance to the Nicaraguan government, basically recognizing them as a legitimate government. The United States said that's not happening, and started its kind of communism scare about Nicaragua, and organized and funded and directed this CIA-backed Contra counter-revolutionary movement out of Honduras and Costa Rica, attacking and killing, you know, some estimates, 50,000, 70,000 Nicaraguans died. Miguel Escoto, a Marian old priest who was the head of the United Nations General Assembly just a few years ago, he was the foreign minister of Nicaragua, and he has called Ronald Reagan the butcher of my people. You know, I think this is where another aspect of solidarity comes in. Yes, Ronald Reagan's the butcher of the Nicaraguan people, and yes, George Bush was the butcher of the people of Iraq and Afghanistan. But we pay our taxes; they go to fund these things. We have responsibility, and the fact that we're not in the streets, protesting, being arrested, and trying to prevent these things doesn't speak really highly of our conviction, the thing that you want, which is, and that I want, and so many want, which is praxis. How do you take all this that we're talking about and put it into action?
So then, through all of these things happening in Nicaragua, what was Witness for Peace's role, and what, how did that affect your understanding of what kind of action to take when you returned to the U.S.?
Well, Witness for Peace operates on an idea that, first of all, you know, we need to stand literally with people in to the extent that our government is responsible for violence in countries, we should stand physically with them. We should be witnesses to what's going on. We should bear witness, gather testimony, you know, do reporting. But also, one of the things key to Witness for Peace was to bring delegations from the United States to Nicaragua. Mostly these were people from faith base, some sort of basis in faith, could be Unitarian, could be Catholic, could be, but not necessarily. It was not, the organization was not exclusively religious based. And so we brought down delegations for, I guess you would call it a educational or solidarity tour or a fact finding. And we met with people both from the government at that time, the Sandinista run government of Daniel Ortega, but also with the opposition. We met with Enrique Bolaños and others who, you know, the Nicaraguan Chamber of Commerce, people who became presidents of Nicaragua subsequently, and to give people a really full perspective of what it was. We spent time in the countryside. We took people to live with families for a few days to experience, you know, in flesh and blood, who these people were, what was their lives like, how, you know, what is the economy of Nicaragua based on. And so, and then the idea was that those folks would come back to the States and help, you know, educate their communities. They would give presentations, slideshows and talks, try to encourage others to also go to Nicaragua or take political action to participate in you know, nonviolent civil disobedience to change U.S. policy. So it was a very powerful movement, and it was going along at the same time that CISPUS was organizing around stopping U.S. Support, billion dollars support for the government in El Salvador. And so that was Witness for Peace. And as far as myself, when I came back, it wasn't long after I was back. I came back because my brother killed himself in 1986. In about 1988, perhaps, I got a call from Kathy Thomas, who was also a Witness for Peace long-term team member when I was there, calling me from Harlingen, Texas, and asking me to come there to be the co-coordinator of an organization called the Rio Grande Defense Committee, El Comité de la Defensa del Rio Grande. And I went to Texas. Basically, the Rio Grande Defense Committee had a similar model to bring delegations from U.S. Churches, communities, and universities to the Rio Grande Valley, both sides, the Rio Bravo, as it's called in Spanish, to take people to the Rio Bravo Valley to see the conditions people were living in. People on the U.S. side who were living without access to water or electricity in these colonias on the U.S. side of the border, the people living over on garbage dumps in Matamoros, the U.S. The maquiladora plants that AT&T and so many other Motorola, so many other U.S. corporations, Japanese, Taiwanese companies have on the border, exploiting cheap Mexican labor, mostly young women, underage women from the interior of Mexico, and so. You know, we wanted people to see that reality so, again, they could impact U.S. policy. They could understand that, you know, these U.S. Electronics corporations were contaminating the area with these highly toxic solvents that they use, like toluene and others that cause neural tube disorders in unborn babies. So that was the purpose of that, and that's kind of what, you know, there's been this thread with me of continuity, I think, that of wanting to have a connection personally with people, Latin Americans in particular.
I think that's huge. That I kind of just had a realization about that the personal connection might be what's missing for a lot of people, because obviously in the late 80s, there wasn't a Facebook to share information on. You know, there wasn't really a functional internet, etc. And I think we kind of take that for granted. And I don't know, do you think that people are desensitized just by the sheer amount of witnessing that they can do on the internet? Do you think it's made it abstract? Do you think that it can still be effective to?
I do. I think that if anything, it oversensitizes you to the point where, like in my case, I can barely talk about this stuff without tears. You know, they certainly well up in my eyes, but no, I don't think it. I think there is an issue of overload and of desensitization, or not desensitization, but our some level at which we just need a break as a human being. We can't, you know, we need to step away and to recapacitate ourselves to be able to deal with the trauma and the pain and of all this. But I think that that human connection is what's missing, you know, that, you know, the family that I lived with in Nicaragua, you know, the in Esteli in particular, I just went back and I saw Berta, and she has a a disease. What is it? One of these that Parkinson's. And she's 60 years old. She took care of me basically when I was in Nicaragua. She was my, you know, mi mamá nicaragüense. That I have that tie so deeply in me, and I learned the language. I mean, so I do think that it's, and in Spokane it's even harder because, despite the fact that Spokane may be slightly more diverse, it really statistically it's not a whole lot diverse than it has been for 10, 20, 30 years. And even to the extent there is some diversity, we don't see those people in this building hardly, or, and it's not to blame anyone. It's just the way it is. It's a very difficult problem. But when you know that you're talking about an issue that affects Marcos Tulio, somebody that you met in Nicaragua, or Berta Celedón, and you know her whole family history back to Benjamin Celedón, a great Nicaraguan anti-imperialist before Sandino, you know, then you can say, I oppose U.S. policy to Nicaragua because I've been there and I know people from there, including our friend Martin Alfaro, who lives here in Spokane, a musician and activist who started a radio program here at the station that's still on the air called Latin Lounge on Monday nights. Martin is a Nicaragüense. And, you know, these are, so solidarity, I think, has to have that component somehow of personal connection with people, even if you don't travel to the country.
Mm-hmm. It does make you pay attention because I, as a senior in high school, participated in an exchange with students from Ecuador who came, and it was in 2008. So Ecuador was in the middle of rewriting their constitution and kind of changing a lot of things about their government. So I got to meet kids, you know, my age from all over, from the cities, and then also indigenous from indigenous families who still were keeping their language alive and their culture and sharing that with us. And now I'm a lot more likely, you know, to pay attention to what's going on in Ecuador and to understand it better, and be able to combat people's misperceptions about the whole region, you know, about South America in general and Latin America in general. I think there's a lot of misperception about what the situation there is, which we saw. I think it has a lot to do with our mainstream media, like you said. And you were in Nicaragua again for the election this last November.
Correct.
Could you talk about that a little bit and what you actually saw firsthand?
Well, because of the way my work is arranged and how leave is scheduled, I wasn't able to go in December, which would have been my preference in terms of like the festivals and things that happen in Nicaragua. But I went in November, and turns out that within a few days of being there, the Nicaraguan elections happen. They happen every 6 years. One of the interesting things about Nicaragua, you know, is the United States engaged in this brutal war against the Sandinistas and the people of Nicaragua and in the 1980s. And in 1990, so the Sandinistas won an election in 1984, and 5 years after the triumph of the revolution, and remained in power. And the elections were to happen every 6 years, so on schedule, 1990 election happens. Sandinistas lose. They turn power over democratically and peacefully to Violeta Chamorro, a representative of a very conservative traditional faction in Nicaragua. And the right runs Nicaragua for 16 years and basically decimates the country and the economy just in the, you know, with the wealthy getting wealthier and the poor getting poorer, just as you might expect anywhere. And in 2006, Daniel Ortega wins the elections again. In 2012, November the 5th, I believe it was, this year, elections were held and Ortega wins again. The international observers that were there and that I talked to were people from the European Commission, an official observer delegation. And despite the fact that the United States claimed that there was massive fraud and threw into doubt the conclusion of the elections, these observers said to me that, yes, there were irregularities. They say that they observe elections all over the world and there are irregularities. They mentioned 2000 in the United States with our elections and 2004. So, you know, that they pointed to. But they said that there was no need for the Sandinistas to engage in voter fraud because there was such massive support that they were going to win the elections. And they did legitimately win the election, according to these European observers, folks that I spoke to in Condega and in San Marcos and in a couple other, in Masaya, I ran into one of their an anthropologist who lives in Mexico who is from Europe. I don't remember if he's from Denmark. Nevertheless, one of the controversies in the 2012 Nicaraguan elections was that, according to the Nicaraguan Constitution, and this is not uncommon in some places in the world, you cannot succeed yourself in office. So if you're president, you cannot be president a consecutive term. And yet Ortega was the candidate for that, for the Sandinista Party, and won the election. So I remember asking on election night at the celebration going on in San Marcos, which is where Martin Alfaro, my friend from Spokane, is from, and is the hometown of Somoza, was originally from San Marcos. So I'm asking these older Sandinista activists about the election, and they said, well, you know, they expressed their happiness over the Sandinista victory, and when I asked why the Sandinistas won, he said, because they've done things concretely for the people. Their program, microloan programs for women. There are, you know, people are being, the government is giving people roofing materials. They call it zinc. It's aluminum roofing material, and other things. People are eating well, and there are health programs. And so I raised the question. I said, pero en cuanto a la cuestión constitucional, what about the constitutional issue, mm-hmm. which was this business of succeeding yourself in office? And they said, es el pueblo quien decide. It's the people that decide. And this is the thing. You know, when Oscar Arias succeeded himself, the Nobel Peace Prize winning, you know, U.S., the darling of the U.S. and the West, was reelected consecutively in Costa Rica, no complaints from the West. When the narco president of Colombia, Uribe, was reelected consecutively, no complaints from the West, and he even tried to be reelected a third time. Uribe did, this narco president of Colombia. So it's all very selective. I personally believe that we had a revolution. What happened with it? Again, the talk that was on the air here just before dealt with some of that. Somehow, the great revolutionary aspirations of the people of the United States were sidetracked. Part of it was the flaws in that original constitution, which was a white landowning male mm-hmm. document. It wasn't the democratic document that people want to make it out to be, But we are a revolutionary people. If we really want to look back in our history, it's been distorted, and we've been beaten literally in other decades, suppressed, even now in Zuccotti Park and other places, literally beaten, gassed, suppressed. And so, you know, basically, at a certain level, we're trying to keep the spirit alive. That's what your program does. That's what's coming out over the airwaves. That's what's so beautiful about this. But that's why, for example, these histories, the Green Progressive Archives that Bob Zeller is working with, or the discussion we just had about CASA here in Spokane and other periods of Spokane history, the free speech movement in the early 1900s, early 20th century, you know, all that, it all comes together in a culture and in a analysis and in a, you know, a spirit of defiance and rebellion and standing up for what's right and what, you know, what we're entitled to as human beings.
Great. So you're listening to Praxis on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane. I'm Taylor Weech here interviewing David Brookbank about all kinds of things, time in Latin America. And then also, so after your initial stint in Nicaragua, coming back in the mid late 80s, is that then when you went to work for the State Department?
Yeah, that is a chapter that's really difficult for me to understand fully myself. And it, you know, it was not good timing in my life, et cetera. But nevertheless, a friend of mine had said to me, hey, you ever taken the Foreign Service exam? I said, well, what's the Foreign Service exam? He said, well, that's how you get into the Foreign Service, the State Department. And I said, no, never crossed my mind. Don't know anything about it. He said, well, there's this exam. You can take it at Gonzaga. And, you know, that's the start of the process. He had taken it and not passed it. He was interested in my perspective on it. So I took it, I passed it. I didn't know what happens next. You go for an oral exam. He said, you're going to go to the oral exam, aren't you? And I said, I hadn't really thought about it, and I don't have a suit, and I don't even know where it is. He said, well, they'll send you the information and get yourself a cheap suit and go over there and do it. So I went, I did it, I passed that exam, and then I'm down in Harlingen at the Rio Grande Defense Committee when I get a call from a security clearance investigator for the State Department and wants to meet with me in a hotel. Basically, he spends quite a bit of time, most of the time, talking to me about how LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, was an SOB, how he stole elections to get into his political career, stole the election to become a U.S. senator. And then he said, you know, if the issue was racism in the South, my parents were racist, he said, and I'm not. And if the issue was racism in the South, I'd be sitting in front of that federal building blocking the doors with you. I just happen to disagree with your politics on Central America. Apparently, at that point, I essentially had, in his mind, passed. He basically took his form out and asked me, you know, are you now or ever have been a member of the Communist Party, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sometime later, I got a letter saying that if I wanted to be in Washington, D.C. for what they call A-100 class, I had a slot, and so I did that. And I found myself with some ex-military. The people going into the State Department are a very unusual mix of people. There are people that have the most offbeat histories you can imagine, but there are also people that are there who work for the CIA, who are basically CIA undercover of state is what it's called. And if you Google CIA undercover of state or undercover of state, you'll see that it's pretty common knowledge. You know, it's not supposed to be, but you can go to the Washington Post and read articles where they talk about that. And people are exposed by foreign governments as being. And so I realized it wasn't until I actually got there. You'd think I would have done my research or something. I actually fully understood where I was and what I was doing. And so basically, I was a vice consul. I interviewed people for visas in Mexico, El Salvador, and Cuba, and did some quote unquote reporting. So, for example, other than giving people visas who might not have gotten visas otherwise, if I hadn't been there with my perspective, like a woman who was a runner for the FMLN in El Salvador, who wanted to go to, she had an invitation to go to San Francisco to give a talk on her days in the guerrilla movement. It's quite possible she would have been denied a visa by anybody else. I don't know that, but I feel when I've thought about, okay, how can I make sense out of this experience? Other than perhaps saying humanizing things to some of my coworkers about the people we were dealing with, because some of these vice consuls I found to be really brutal, unkind, not nice, some would say evil people, which could explain how they can operate in the midst of U.S. foreign policy. But I had the opportunity, because of my work with the Rio Grande Defense Committee and my connection with some human rights groups on the Mexico side, when I worked for at the consulate in Matamoros, I received a phone call from a woman. I was there from 1992 to 1994. So on the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas went into effect on January 1st, 1994. That midnight, the night of New Year's, the 31st of December, the 1st of January, the Zapatista uprising occurred, taking the whole country and the world by surprise. Here we're going to have this great free trade agreement, you know, between these countries, and here's this revolutionary movement that springs up in the jungles. And I got a call about February from a woman who worked with Arturo Solis, now deceased, head of a Reynoso-based human rights group, asking me to come to meet with her in an office. It turned out that there had been there was a exhibit of photographs by journalists and human rights people who had gone to southern Mexico and taken pictures of the repression by the Mexican government against the Zapatistas and these communities in the mountains of indigenous people. A photograph of a dog eating the brains out of a skull and things of that sort. The kind of brutality that Latin America has been subjected to since the arrival of the Europeans. They had set up in the plaza, the main plaza of Matamoros, rain came, they moved into the Casa Mata, which is a municipal museum. And they were there a few days, several days. Teachers were bringing students to see the exhibit. It was very, people were very interested in it. You know, Mexico has a revolutionary history, and basically just last week, probably the third election in the last five elections were stolen from the left, from the Partido de la Revolución Democrática, the PRD. And so there is great dissent in Mexico. People were interested in this exhibit. On Sunday morning, a young man, nicely dressed in shades, showed up, saw the exhibit. The people that running the exhibit sensed that he was, and I don't know why they would have sensed this exactly, but that he was military intelligence. He showed up later with the general who runs the Plaza Guarda, General de la Plaza, Guarnición de la Plaza. And they then, so they left, and then someone came and said, oh, we didn't tell you this, but we need you to leave the exhibit site today because we have a fumigation of the site scheduled. So they began taping the windows up, and they had to move the site out. They moved it to a law office, and the woman closed the door to the office and said to me, you know, Arturo asked me to call you, want you to know what's going on. I've had to move into an interior room in my house with my kids because of threats that are being made to us. I fear that they're going to drive by the house and fire upon our house. And I was able to at least report so that people at the State Department could, you know, at least not say that they didn't know about this. Mm-hmm. There was very little that I could do working for the State Department. It's possible that a person could spend 30 years and get to a position that, like Tex Harris did, who's the person in the State Department that finally convinced the U.S. government that the Madres de la Plaza in Argentina, the Mothers of the Plaza, had a legitimate, you know, issues about these disappearances. The U.S. government knew it, but they finally had to address it. Ambassador Robert White, who was U.S. ambassador to El Salvador in the early 80s, when Reagan was president, and he resigned from the State Department, wrote a dissenting white paper, as they call it, bringing attention to the U.S. support for this repressive government, and left the State Department. I was not a person who was going to be able to stay that long. And besides, I had my son here that I couldn't stand to be away from mm-hmm. any longer. Lucas, who you know, I know.
Mm-hmm. He's a good kid. But that's something that's always been interesting to me. A lot of people through the years when I've kind of become more politically active, at least, you know, talking about it more and being more interested, have suggested, you know, the only way to do it is to get into office or to go work. You know, my grandma suggested to me multiple times to go work for the State Department. And that seems to be kind of the route that you're encouraged to take if you want to change things. But you're saying that, you know, in reality, it would take 30 years to do that.
To be in a position where you could actually do something as dramatic as what Robert White did, yes. But, you know, there was a young State Department Foreign Service officer who resigned, I think, during the Bosnia conflict that got a fair amount of attention. There are people that have left the State Department in the Iraq scenario that have gotten attention. I don't think you would have to go that long. You would certainly learn some things. But here's the problem. I don't know how well we know ourselves as human animals, and the extent to which the human animal, our neurological system, can be co-opted by things like some people in the context of the Foreign Service with a black diplomatic passport and access to the halls of power, even though they're not. Very high up the pecking order, they are not going to leave that life. It provides too many perks. They suddenly see, well, I'm going to educate my children in Europe, and I'm going to go see exotic places, and I'm going to go up the pay scale, and maybe I'll be an ambassador. They're not going to leave that. And I think there's some danger to it. I think we see it with politicians all the time. Mm-hmm. I fear for each one of these progressives that people want to support here locally to go from here to Olympia. Because if they went to Olympia because they suddenly realized one day that it was Olympia where the laws are made that affect what's going on here, won't they get to Olympia and say, some of them who may be more susceptible to, you know, the perks and privileges of power and say, well, once I got to Olympia, I realized that it's actually in Washington, D.C. where the laws are made. And if you look at the voices coming out of Olympia and out of Washington, D.C., there aren't many radical voices mm-hmm. coming from the halls of power.
There's about a handful.
A handful. Yeah. So how many progressive, left, committed people once decided, I'm going to run for office and change it from within, mm-hmm. and then got to Washington, D.C., and there's just this silence or this support for the system mm-hmm. coming from their mouths and their actions. So everyone is different. And, you know, I left. I survived it. I was confused. Mm-hmm. I mean, why was I there? I asked myself it often, but I had to put on a tie and, do and work for them and wear their badge and for four and a half years. But I also gained knowledge. I'll just share one thing that I gained, which was we all went to the State Department or to the CIA as a class. No big deal. All kinds of people go there. But they took us into a room, red light went on, and we saw a video. The video was about diplomatic security, being how to be safe abroad. No big deal. But the person narrating the video was the NPR reporter Ann Garrels. I don't know if you know who Ann Garrels is, mm-hmm. but she had extraordinary access, obviously, in Iraq from before the invasion and through. There, you know, her reporting was astounding, but clearly she had some kind of additional access. Well, she's married to a former CIA agent who was one of the founders of Air America in Laos. His name is, he's an artist. He lives in Connecticut. And his name is James Vinton, I believe was his cover name. Anyways, you can Google it and you'll, mm-hmm. I created the Google post for him, the connection for him and Ann Garrels on that website. The point is, working for the State Department for me was a reinforced my worldview. I came to understand that the top levels of that organization are controlled by deep insiders of the U.S. government, which is evident today. Who more than Hillary Clinton is mm-hmm. a deep insider in the U.S. government and a guardian of the dynasty, you could say.
So something that I was discussing this with my boyfriend this morning, talking about what we had talked about CIA undercover mm-hmm. state and just the deep intermeshing of all these different agencies and the obvious chaos it sometimes leads to when it comes out, you know, that these agents didn't know who the others were working for mm-hmm. and things like that. And we talked about, you know, there are these people. We started talking about these people that are deep, mm-hmm. Deeply embedded. How does a culture like that continue after those individual people go? Is it just such a toxic culture that it permeates to the next generation of those who come in?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, clearly they do their vetting of people. How I got through that vetting process, I don't know. You know, my dad was a B-52 pilot. I was actually appointed to the Air Force and Naval Academies by Tom Foley and Warren Magnuson. I didn't go for a long story. But probably they looked at my history and said, okay, look, the guy is, you know, he's in Nicaragua. But we met with him. He's a reasonable guy. He comes from he's white male. He comes from a middle-class family. He's worked for government, state government, albeit, but nevertheless, he's exactly the kind of person that we co-opt with diplomatic passports and salaries and access to travel. And, you know, the guy will be, he'll provide us information when you assign him to Nicaragua. He'll know how to go out to the countryside and mm-hmm. assess things. And he'll come back, and since we edit he won't get to write his own reports. He writes for us. You know, we won't let him say anything. I mean, that's kind of the way I see how it works. And it's a self-perpetuating situation. The weight of the institutions, the physical buildings, for example, and the infrastructure of these embassies, you know, this massive embassy in Iraq, or even the embassy in El Salvador, the largest in Central America, which is the CIA station in Central America, or Mexico City, or, I mean, these are physical presences with U.S. Marines who guard the facilities, or in Cuba, it's Seabees, and it's part of the of empire and the maintenance of empire, and they, you know, the empire intends to perpetuate itself, and it's our job to say the empire is anti-democratic, the empire is anti-constitutional, it's anti, you know, it's destructive of many values and things and lives and nations and cultures, and to try. But I do think it has a weight and a momentum that does perpetuate itself from generation to generation. The way the State Department works to a certain extent is you get mentored by somebody up above you, and you become a water walker, and you rise through the ranks, and pretty soon you're in inner circles where you're not a lot of people walk away from that. And obviously I was at the bottom levels. I never, but I certainly got a feel for how it works.
So back to the empire, you know, we have at least a physical presence in 164, over half of the countries on Earth, I believe, we're in physically. And that's just, you know, documented that we're there. How do you think, since it's such a vast web, how do you think that people can best address the issue in a coherent way and take action toward dismantling such a large destructive thing?
Well, the number you used, I think, is correct, 164, 174, something. I think it's much more than half. We have global reach. It's a vast empire. We buy people off. We have allies, in high places. Corporations are used as vehicles for, you know, communication and for transmission of policy, and they, again, corporations themselves are part of the corrupt structures. As far as what we do with the fact that it's so vast, I personally would come back to this kind of cross-pollination, this communication and connection with people all over the world. I think one of the things that's most exciting is these social forums. These world social forums. I would love to go to a world social forum. I haven't been to one, but I'm going to go. These world social forums, these events like the G8 and the NATO, events or the WTO in Seattle, where people register in a way that can't be ignored, although the media is getting really good at ignoring it. You asked me about free speech zones before we went on the air. You know, they'll segregate you miles away in a free speech zone. You're free to talk. We just don't want you over here where the people that are going to be doing the big business might actually hear you, or where you might, you know, distract us from our policing role or something. I think that all we can do, I think we have a long way to go. I think there's reason for hope. It's not Obama, it's not obviously Romney, it's not the two-party ruling class consensus, it's not, it's something that is being, we've started to realize, which are these, whether it's Occupy, Los Indignados, the continuity between us and, you know, these movements in the past, what we have yet to build, but information obviously is key. For a place like Spokane, this program, I mean, radiating out into this community with Fairchild Air Force Base, with the SEER program, the Survival, Escape, Rescue, and Evasion, or Survival, Evasion, Rescue, and Escape program, with the tortures, development of more effective torture by these two psychologists right down the street here in the American Legion building, the remnants of what they were doing that's still here in that building, a man by the name of Spivey. If you look on the back of that building, go look at the parking tags there. You'll see Spivey Associates and look him up online, Randall Spivey. The militarization of the Spokane police, which was an issue that was brought up by the new mayor, Mayor Condon's transition committee, raised as one of the issues that needed to be addressed, the demilitarization of the Spokane police. not the militarization of it, but the demilitarization. It's already militarized with their AR-15s, and now people speculating on how soon we'll have drones here, which is soon, I would say.
That was actually on the local news. Gavin Dahl followed up with Joel Sullivan of The Inlander on his drone article just this morning.
I have to listen to that.
Yeah, that's on again at 4:30.
I'll definitely be listening.
Because that's coming, if not already here. So.
And see, this local news coverage that KRS is doing, again, is key. I mean, information is never going to stop being key. The way we transmit that and share that information, I think there's some things missing in Spokane, one of which is some sort of effective, I don't want to say effective, because I think this, for example, the local Palestine group that's
through Pajals
mm-hmm. is effective. Two members have just come back from the Middle East. I think they were in Gaza. I'm not sure. Hopefully more people will go. But that organization needs to be larger. We need some kind of a strong, impassioned solidarity organization here that is whatever group of people it is, wherever in the world, that we're doing more than just what Spokane seems to be very involved in, which is sending missionaries, Christian missionaries, over to countries to save souls and maybe give people glasses or do dental work. And I'm not minimizing those things. But we need to strengthen that connection with people around the world, because it's a global empire, and we're not going to effectively confront it and defeat it without global solidarity. It's not we are not capable of doing it on our own, I don't believe. In fact, we are probably one of the weaker populations in terms of our analysis, our consciousness, and our willingness to act on the planet.
Well, you see that with, I like that your focus is on solidarity rather than service, because so many times that's misguided. It's, we need to feed these children, so let's send them food rather than addressing the reason why they're hungry, you know? And we saw that. I talked on my show during the huge blow up of the Kony 2012 campaign, which was such a misguided, sketchily funded, but really grabbed on to people's imagination. There were posters everywhere in downtown Spokane. And if you can imagine that happening for an issue that was actually relevant, with information that actually made sense for the people there and had been discussed with them, that for me was, it made me really angry, because that's what it was about. But it also made me very hopeful that, you know, people had the energy to get out and do that.
Well, I know we're near the end of our time, and I just want to thank you, and I commend you for this program and KRS for making the space available. Just keep sending the word out. Making the word became flesh, and people heard it, and then they were motivated to action, and we continued to try to create the kind of world that we all want.
Yeah, thank you for all the work you've done. And it's really great for me as a young person to be able to get some historical perspective on what's already happened here, and what is yet to come. And also, thank you for your blog. It's funny that last week, talking about police state stuff, I happened to stumble on your blog, having already scheduled you for the following week. And I said, I don't know who wrote this great blog, but I thank them. So
Spokane, policeabuses.wordpress.com. Yeah.
And I can thank link you to that on my Facebook page. And this show will later be podcast at kyrs.org. Thanks for joining me. It's been Praxis with David Brookbank on Monday, July 9th, 2012. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.